Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin. And just for you, this is breadboxmedia.com. On Setting the Record Straight, we uncover the truth about the glorious history of the Catholic Church. So we'll begin. We got a rather interesting subject today. I wonder if you've read Robinson Crusoe, maybe when you were young. It's a great novel by Daniel Defoe. Shipwrecked with Robinson Crusoe. That's what we are. Am I saying we're shipwrecked? I certainly am. You'll see what I mean as we go along. In an article published a few years back in the treasurable First Things periodical, author Paul Zaleski wrote an article entitled The Strange Shipwreck of Robinson Crusoe. It made a deep impression on me. I still haven't forgotten it. I'm saving that article. When I tried to tell people, including one person who is a dealer in young people's books, when I tried to tell them what Zaleski has written, they said his observations were wild conjecture. They used very uncomplimentary terms that I won't repeat here on Catholic radio. But Zaleski had not just written his opinion. He was making factual observations about the text of the book Robinson Crusoe. I checked. He was correct. I do know I run into this frequently in people in this age will deny that any age prior to ours was inhabited by people of superior virtue to ours, or even to superior intelligence of ours. Well, I must say that I've seen evidence that both propositions contain a lot of truth. When Robinson Crusoe was reread by Paul Zaleski, he came upon a cultural artifact that is of enormous interest. It's not opinion that one denies. He walked away with facts about our age and the age that Daniel Defoe was writing in. I want to condense some of his thoughts and paraphrase him, and perhaps quote him a bit, because what he had to say is troubling and interesting and revelatory. He had decided to reread one of the favorite books of his boyhood. What he had to say about Robinson Crusoe is that the crucial issue in the book's great gift is Daniel Defoe's account of how a civilization is born, what transforms chaos into cosmos, survivalism into society, is obedience to God. The book is so famous that Robinson Crusoe is often taken to be a real man who suffered a real shipwreck, a mixture of fiction and fact that reminds you of Sherlock Holmes, who many people believe really existed. Like Sherlock, Robinson Crusoe is fictitious. He did not ever exist. That he exists as a book is a miracle. Few could have predicted such a masterpiece of good feeling and fortitude from a man described by Jonathan Swift as a grave, sententious, dogmatic rogue. Defoe was a bit of a scoundrel. The best physical description of him comes to us fittingly from a wanted poster. A middle-sized, spare man, about 40 years old, of a brown complexion and dark brown-colored hair, but wears a wig, a hooked nose, a sharp chin, gray eyes, and a large mole near his mouth. What's amazing is Defoe churned out 7 other books the same year, but the popularity of this book was instant and undying. Account taken in 1979 found 1,198 editions in English alone, and it's been translated into many other languages. So Paul Zaleski decided to reread it, and he picked up a Norton Critical Edition. And he picked it up eagerly, he says, anticipating what his boyhood memories assured him was a streamlined adventure story, a child's story, with none of the ambiguities of the adult world. What could be simpler? Shipwreck and survival. But he was amazed. The book was heavier, thicker than he remembered, thicker in style, too, he says. He decided he must have read an abridged version when he was young. Abridged versions are often well done, but he was comforted by the first sentence, which reads, I was born in the year 1632 in the city of York, of a good family, though not of that country. my father being a foreigner of Bremen, who settled first at Hull. So Zaleski sighed with pleasure and settled into his armchair. But as the plot unfolded, there were so many things he didn't remember.
Robinson seemed so noisy and out of control, and he didn't remember him having such a miserable early life. Before he reached page 30, he read that Robinson had been a slaver. Well, maybe they had left that part out to protect his boyhood sensibilities.
But then he realized something much worse was amiss.
Not only was Robinson Crusoe's character quite different,
but the very significance of his shipwreck, the very meaning of his life was different. What he discovered in the unabridged Robinson Crusoe clashed in every important point of substance and style with the abridged Robinson Crusoe that he remembered from boyhood. Moreover, what seemed to be missing from his childhood version, and what loomed before him in Defoe's original text, was hardly material one would wish to hide from children. On the contrary, the most savage cuts, those that tore the heart out of the novel, had removed just those passages I would have thought any parent would most want his child to read.
Well, you be the judge. Let's go over what Paul Zaleski found out. And you be the judge, whether this experience is unique or whether it exposes a grave truth about our culture.
This is a famous story. Almost everyone knows the broad outlines of it.
A man is shipwrecked without resources on a desert island, survives for years by his own wits, undergoes immeasurable anguish as a result of his isolation, discovers a footprint in the sand that belongs to Friday, and is finally rescued from his exile. This outline fits that in our common memory. 99 out of 100 people would agree with it. The problem with it is that all of it is wrong. Robinson's Island is not a desert in our modern sense of the word. He does not proceed without resources. He does not live solely by his wits. He does not suffer inordinately for his solitude. And that famous footprint, the best known in the world, does not belong to Friday. Even the word rescue for Robinson's eventual escape from the island is false. But more significant than any of these details is that our overall perception of the book is wrong. The single most important fact about this boy's adventure book is that it is not a boy's adventure book at all. It is rather a grown-up tale of a man's discovery of himself, of civilization, and of God. As the book begins, Robinson Crusoe of York commits what he calls his original sin. He spurns his father's advice to join the family business, and goes to sea. The young man is self-willed, arrogant, and hungry for exploits. Catastrophes ensue, storms, shipwrecks, slavery, but the lad continues in his follies. I was, he confesses, to be the willful agent of all my own miseries. Then Providence gives him a second chance by shipwrecking him on an Atlantic island whose features roughly match those of the Juan Fernandez group in the Pacific Ocean, where Robinson's real-life prototype, Alexander Selkirk, passed 7 years in solitude. Robinson's Island is a pristine land of surpassing beauty. To its forlorn first inhabitant, it seemed nothing short of Eden. He described it, saying the country appeared so fresh, so green, so flourishing, everything being in a constant verdure or flourish of spring, that it looked like a planted garden. So he builds a new home without Eve. Alas, such is his penance. He also builds a new self in the Pauline sense. He thinks, put off your old nature, which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through deceitful lusts, and be renewed in the spirit of your minds, and put on the new nature created after the likeness of God in true righteousness and holiness. Robinson no longer follows his own will, but bows before the will of God. He learns to see in his calamities the work of Providence, and to discern the hand of God at every moment in his life. He opens his Bible and repents, calling out, Lord, be my help. His appeal to God does not go unheard. As Robinson surrenders to God, the island surrenders to him. Step by step, he recapitulates in miniature the rise of civilization. He handles a tool for the first time, and builds himself a chair and a table. He needs a shovel, so he makes one. Never was a shovel so long in making. He hammers together a wall, plants a field. keeps a herd of goats. As his conversion deepens, so does his fortune. He builds a second establishment deep inland. "I fancy now I had my country house and my seacoast house," he declares himself, "lord of all this country as completely as any lord of a manor in England." All this can be shrugged off as a crude example of Protestant work ethic. Sweat enough and your lot will increase. But this flip analysis ignores the crucial issue and the book's great gift. Defoe's account of how a civilization is born. What transforms chaos into cosmos, survivalism into society, is obedience to God. "I acquiesced in the dispositions of Providence, which I began now to own and to believe, ordered everything for the best." So profound is his transformation that he comes to thank God for his sad shipwreck. "I began sensibly to feel how much more happy this life was, with all its miserable circumstances, than the wicked, cursed, abominable life I led all the past part of my days." So through God's mercy, Robinson's life is spared, his soul cleansed, and civilization born. When Friday appears, the process repeats itself. Robinson names Friday, clothes him, arms him, teaches him to make fire and bake bread, gives him the keys to the treasury of Western history, science, and religion. Through his newfound wisdom, Robinson is able to share with others the good harvest he has reaped. He saves Friday's father and a Spaniard from cannibals and becomes a king. "I thought myself very rich in subjects. I was absolute lord and lawgiver. They all owed their lives to me." Why don't we take a break now? See you on the other side. Chuck Coughlin here on Setting the Record Straight.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. Before the break here on Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin, we were discussing the real story of Robinson Crusoe, as opposed to the abridged and censored ones that are in most of our libraries and bookstores. Let's take up the story where we left off. Robinson's life comes full circle when he rescues a boatload of Englishmen. The grateful mariners see in their delivery not a Job afflicted by God's cruel whims, but a divine messenger. "He must be sent directly from heaven," says one, another victim of shipwreck, to which Robinson replies with the humility of the truly converted, "All help is from heaven." Defoe's story achieves its ironic end as Robinson, now an agent of God's providence, maroons a shipload of pirates and returns to Europe a wealthy man, respected for his kindness and generosity. The authentic Robinson Crusoe can be considered a sort of a textbook about the appropriate relationships among human beings, culture, and God. The lessons are clear. Welfare and worship are inseparable. Both the well-ordered state and the well-ordered individual rest squarely upon the divine. Every component of civilization, shelter, handicraft, agriculture, animal husbandry, law, art, and worship ultimately depend upon a vigorous relationship with God. Zaleski insists that his is not an eccentric reading of the text. The spiritual depths are evident to everyone he gets to read it unabridged. He includes it on a syllabus. His students are thunderstruck by the power of Robinson's conversion. In just this way, as a manual of conversion and guide to the good life, was Robinson understood for centuries. In an effort to set the record straight, Zaleski does some research. He comes upon reviews and observations from the past. One from 1790 says, "Few books have ever so naturally mingled amusement with instruction. The attention is fixed either by the simplicity of the narration or by the variety of the incidents. The heart is amended by a vindication
of the ways of God to man. Zaleski decides that the version of the book that he read as a child, The Abridgment, was a case of bulderization, but a very particular type of bulderization, in which the scissors snipped away at something other than scatological language, or gore, or sizzling sex. The truth is much more startling. All the religion had been excised, scissored out. Again and again, one particular word had been removed, along with every scene inspired by that word. What was this obscenity too dangerous for the eyes of children? It's a word of three letters. The word was God. He thought, this can't be. Perhaps the version he'd read as a child was some sort of outlier. Perhaps some atheist did this as a joke. So he went to a well-stock library, and they had a number of copies of Robinson Crusoe on the shelves. Almost all of them were abridgments. Every single one showed the same bleak pattern, the evisceration from the text of almost every scrap or shred of religion. He writes about a typical example. It's a Doubleday Classics edition, entitled Robinson Crusoe. The book had no date, but the illustrations were copyrighted 1945. He hoped this might be the same version he had read as a boy. The front piece had a delightful drawing of Robinson, umbrella in hand, as if out for a stroll on the beach, and discovering the footprint. Almost anybody picking up this book would assume this to be the authentic and complete Robinson Crusoe, most especially because there was no mention of abridgment on the title page or anywhere else. However, this is Robinson Crusoe after a visit from the Thought Police. Let's take, for example, the hero's journal, kept at the beginning of his exile. The entries for June 27th through July 4th, 1660, stretch for over 3,000 words and contain some of Robinson's most exalted religious writing as he nearly succumbs to a terrible fever and utters, quote, the first prayer, if I may call it so, that I had made for many years. Recovering from an illness, Robinson reads the Bible. I quote, I threw down the book, and with my heart as well as my hands lifted up to heaven, in a kind of ecstasy of joy, I cried out aloud, Jesus, thou Son of David, Jesus, thou exalted Prince and Savior, give me repentance. This was the first time I could say in the true sense of the words that I prayed in all my life. For now I prayed with a sense of my condition, and with a true scriptural view of hope, founded on the encouragement of the Word of God. And from this time, I may say, I have begun to have hope that God would hear me. Well, God did hear Robinson, but readers of this Doubleday edition certainly won't, for the passage quoted above in many ways, the core of the book, has been completely removed. Moreover, Defoe's 3,000-word account of Robinson's soul wrestlings has been sliced in half, and, as you might expect by now, all references to Christ have been erased. This sad version of the book, unfortunately, was not the worst example of those he examined. He said what was truly mind-boggling was a 1977 book, The Adventures of Robinson Crusoe, a version that at least admits what it is about, declaring itself as adapted. Well, that's honest enough. But here, any hint of divine providence is simply chopped away wholesale, as if removing a cancer. The pesky word God, which appears hundreds of times in Defoe's original text, remains in only 10 places, and usually in very conventional places, for example. For God's sake, Smith, throw down your arms. Not a hint of Robinson's conversion remains. Zaleski reflected that most adults draw their knowledge of Robinson Crusoe from abridged versions scanned in childhood. They don't usually read it as adults. Moreover, if they wanted to experience Robinson Crusoe again, most adults wouldn't turn to the unabridged original book, but to the movies. So he decided to look at some of the movies. Only one version was available. Crusoe, 1989, starring Aidan Quinn. It was an R-rated film. He thought surely in an R-rated film there might be a little room for God, but he'd forgotten Hollywood's tendency, compulsion, for rewriting history. Sure enough, every sign of Robinson's conversion had been removed. Crusoe, the movie, manages the neat feat of completely reversing DeVoe's intent, transforming Robinson into an anti-religious tract in which our hero utters but one prayer, a desperate plea to God to spare the life of his dog. The prayer goes unanswered. Unspoken premise, no God exists to answer the prayer. The film also inverts Robinson's tutelage of Friday. The native learns no English, but the Englishman goes native, dropping his tattle manners and learning to worship the sun and sand. But at least Crusoe does not apply for membership in Friday's cannibal tribe. That weird turn of events was realized in the mercifully hard-to-obtain movie 1975, Man Friday, starring Peter O'Toole as Robinson and Richard Roundtree in the title role as Friday. In this movie, Orthodox religion is not ignored, as in Crusoe, but mocked without mercy. Robinson proves to be a fool, God approved, Christian faith a sign of mental illness. The voice of reason, warmth, and love belongs to Friday. At least in this respect, Man Friday conforms to DeVoe's intent. For in the original, Friday is indeed a kind and perceptive man. But just when writer Adrian Mitchell seems to have gotten something right, it blows up in his face. For Man Friday presents a Friday who has hung out too long at Woodstock. His tribe has more in common with a hog farm or Summerhill than with any real pre-industrial society. It is a blissful communal family, free of such Western hang-ups as ambition or competition, and practices free love, polymorphously perverse, of course. The tribe's religion, too, has burst free of the chains of orthodoxy and offers instead a philosophy of be your own friend. Margaret Mead would be proud. It appears to be a book inspired by her fraudulent book, Coming of Age in Samoa, which did such damage in the 60s, 70s, and 80s among the youth of our country by representing as true a set of amusing lies describing a child's fantasy of a hedonistic lifestyle. They were later showed, by later careful studies, to be a set of wishful stories made up to please the naive young anthropologist who was spending only 3 weeks in Samoa before writing her book. Here, decades later, I still find most people believe the book authentic. And I would spare Margaret Mead criticism if later in her life she had recanted. It does hurt. As a young man, I have such esteem for her. And I was fooled. The damage goes on. She remains a very respected name in the public mind. Let me explain this diversion. I wanted to point out that Robinson Crusoe is only part of a vast fabric of a culture which suffers from the same decomposition and demolition of truth that is occurring every day in the rest of our culture. Unfortunately, what happened to Robinson Crusoe is part of the general pattern. And having lost faith in our pole star, our culture has been shipwrecked on a desert island. In the authentic version, Robinson Crusoe, in the wilderness, had brought his Christianity with him. He had a Bible. On the desert island that we've been shipwrecked upon, in the wilderness we're lost in, we must now pray to God to make us fortunate enough to find his footprint in the sand, somewhere in the chaotic wreckage and flotsam and jetsam strewn upon the beach.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. And just for you, this is BreadboxMedia.com. We're back again. This is Chuck Coughlin, Setting the Record Straight. We're talking today about Robinson Crusoe and how it has been censored and how many versions of it that are available today for young people and adults to read have been abridged in a way that censors out any mention of God or religion. Now, Philip Zaleski observes in his article that it's not difficult to see Robinson Crusoe as a parable of our own condition. And that's how I've been presenting it here. Robinson Crusoe was shipwrecked, and we are too, cut off from the mainland of religious tradition, shipwrecked on the shoals of secularism. Our culture as a whole has suffered the same fate as Defoe's book, a systematic purging of religious content. What happened to Robinson Crusoe as a book is indicative of what's happening elsewhere in general. But Zaleski succumbs to another era of our times, in that he apologizes for suggesting in any way that there's a conspiracy. Oh no, it can't be a conspiracy. Many people think we've just been experiencing a cultural drift, a tide that goes in and out. Well, I have to disagree with that. There's a whole nother literature, and it's nonfiction literature, that I delve into from time to time on Setting the Record Straight. It's accurate histories, and there's plenty of them. None dare call it a conspiracy, so let's don't. Let's just call it willfully misrepresenting history and altering artworks, much like smashing stained glass windows, for political or propaganda purposes. There's a better word for it. It's called iconoclasm, but that word, too, has lost its original meaning. It means smashing icons, smashing sacred objects. So censoring the content of Robinson Crusoe is iconoclasm. It's an old theme of human history, iconoclasm. There's a whole literature, volumes and volumes, on the subject of what happened to our culture, the subversion of our culture in the 20th century. The documentation is extensive and responsible, and it includes things like the KGB archives, which document in great detail how our culture was subverted. It's a mistake to call it a conspiracy, because it's not descriptive. It's too big, it's too public, but like the Emperor's New Clothes, it just cannot be seen. The term conspiracy is so degraded now that to use it discredits oneself. What it was an open, large-scale project to secularize our culture. It was achieved by persons who became famous for doing so. I think instantly of Otto von Bismarck and his culture comp, his culture war against the Catholic Church in Germany in the 1800s. There's others, well described in responsible history books, the Frankfurt School, John Dewey, Stalin, Ion Pachepka, who participated in it, converted to Christianity and wrote a book about his efforts with the Stasi and the KGB to create a false history about Pope Pius XII, which is commonly believed. A very artful disinformation is an information that is more believable than reality. Reality is often a little bit improbable. Therefore, it's not very hard to construct artful lies. When Zaleski writes this, quote, "At no time, I am convinced, was there a deliberate suppression of Robinson's religion in order to buttress secular claims," unquote. Well, if the alteration of Robinson Crusoe and the scissoring out of his religion and mentions of God was not done consciously in order to buttress secular claims, then for what reason did it occur? It's obvious that that was the reason. The man with the scissors could not have been unconscious, did too good a job of it. I do agree it's not a conspiracy, if by conspiracy we mean something secret. It was quite public. But Philip Zaleski has done an admirable job in his First Things article. I know my disagreement is a little quibble. Perhaps we should call it a campaign. If so, it was a campaign to put us asleep. Because how asleep must we be if we have an inability to read history with any rigor and see that we have an allergy to the sacred? Zaleski includes some contemporary ideas about Robinson Crusoe. Quote, this is from J.R. Hammond in a Defoe Companion, who announces, "Today we no longer read the story as a religious parable, but recognize it as an allegory of the human condition." Hammond takes for granted a divorce between religion and the, quote, human condition. Still worse is Martin Green's 1990 appraisal of a compilation of Methodist sermons entitled The Gospel of Robinson Crusoe. This compilation reads Defoe's tale for what it is, a story of spiritual travail. The book came out in 1955. This book, says Green, was, quote, simply out of date. It was a mere oddity. Any audience it may have had in 1955 must have belonged to a special group, out of step with a majority. Such, Green assures us, is the consensus of, quote, men and women of letters, unquote. So what do people in the 20th century make of Robinson Crusoe anyway? They see him as a Marxist hero, for one thing. In 1933, the Soviet Writers' Circle declared Defoe, along with Jules Verne and Jonathan Swift, as one of the three great four novelists of the cause. Presumably, Stalinists took their cue from Marx, who declared Robinson Crusoe in Das Kapital, of his prayers and the like we take no account. Marx instead upheld Robinson as the representative of, quote, a community of free individuals carrying on their work with the means of production in common, unquote. Rousseau, that old rascal, by contrast, imagined Robinson as a prototype of the noble savage. Of course he did. Other critics have seen in Defoe's book a parable about imperialism or social progress or even Oedipal conflicts. But the truth is, that reading Robinson as a lesson in economics or psychology or pedagogy is akin to reading Moby Dick for its tips on whale harvesting. What does it really matter? Why care about these distortions of Robinson Crusoe? It does matter. Philip Zaleski gives five reasons. I like the first one. He said it matters first of all because truth matters. I suppose we all agree about that. Secondly, because Robinson Crusoe matters. Robinson Crusoe matters in its own right as a splendid novel that deserves to remain intact. Yes, this is the argument against the image smashers, the iconoclasts. And Robinson matters, he goes on, in the history of the novel. Many critics count Defoe's masterpiece as not just the most famous novel in the world, but the first novel in the world. This judgment depends on definition, of course, and you could offer the earlier Don Quixote. Nonetheless, all critics agree that Robinson Crusoe stands as a primordial example of form. It is also unquestionably the first English novel, progenitor of a glorious stream, whose current encompasses Fielding, Dickens, Graham, and Lewis. There's some loose ends in the plot. The text is long-winded, repetitious, sometimes crude. Dickens pointed out that Defoe handles emotion poorly. He said, Robinson is the only example of a universally popular book that can make no one laugh and no one cry. Its structure sags. Edgar Allan Poe remarked that we close the book and are quite satisfied that we could have written as well ourselves. Yet, Robinson Crusoe shines with power and beauty, power that stems from the universality of its hero's plight. It's almost mythical, so elemental that it approaches myth. Beauty that lies in the majesty of his redemption. Defoe may have been a little bit conscious of his role as father of the novel, because he gives us at the very origin of the genre, this work, that addresses the origin and destiny of human beings, of justice, freedom, of the state, civilization itself, and he identifies the source of these essential matters just where they must be found, in the very origin of all things. Zaleski gives us a third reason. It matters. Because the art of the novel itself matters. Although now movies are more popular than novels, novels remain first when it comes to intellectual clout. For example, would you rather get an Oscar or the Nobel Prize for Literature? Moreover, the novel is the art of the public square, with no competition. By the very nature of its production and distribution, the novel cannot be privatized, as can say painting, which made a disastrous swerve towards subjectivity after World War I. And now no one takes it seriously anymore. There are a lot of bad novels, but good novels like Brother Karamazov, Pale Fire and Silence, The Power and the Glory by Graham Greene, invariably deal with the relationships between people or between people and God and the moral implications of these relationships. It's important that a novelist works alone. Each novel is as individual and as universal as a prayer. The fourth reason is our discussion matters because art matters. It matters because beauty matters. And the truths matter toward which beauty points our way. You might say that a good test of a culture, the litmus test for a society, is its sense of beauty. Real beauty is a matter of rightness. Real beauty always unfolds in a moral landscape. It reflects its order, intelligence, and harmonious dispositions, these same qualities in their transcendent state. Zaleski feels that real beauty never divides, degrades, or corrupts. It weds, elevates, and purifies. He says beauty always leads to God, for God is beautiful and he loves beauty. For beauty summons all things to itself, as Dionysus observed. You could put it this way. Real beauty converts. Once conversion takes place, as Defoe shows in Robinson Crusoe, the human being expresses his love for the divine order through the beauty of his own creations. Might be straw basket, might be a symphony. In this enterprise, we draw nearer to God's mysterious working. Here's how the Catechism of the Catholic Church puts it. To the extent that it is inspired by truth and love of being, art bears a certain likeness to God's activity and what he has created. There's more after the break on Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
This is Setting the Record Straight. This is Chuck Coughlin. And just for you, this is BreadboxMedia.com. We're together again. The break's over. And you know you're on BreadboxMedia.com. Innovative and remarkable concept. Very creative. I know you're looking at our webpage, BreadboxMedia.com. There's a reward for you. There's a buried treasure for you. Click on Bless the Yes and take a look. Back to talking about Robinson Crusoe. The book that Philip Zaleski loved so much as a child, ran read as an adult, and found out that it had been horribly mutilated. All the parts about religion and God were scissored out. That's what they used to do to Shakespeare, clean him up. A man named Boulder did it. It's called boulderizing something. It means taking out any offensive parts. And often that process removes the very lifeblood and vitals of whatever artwork is being operated on. You know, there's some interesting things about the book. It has a subtitle I really love. Listen to this. The Life and Strange Surprising Adventures of Robinson Crusoe of York, Mariner, who lived 8 and 20 years all alone in an uninhabited island on the coast of America, near the mouth of the great river of Orinoco. Having been cast on shore by shipwreck, wherein all the men perished but himself, with an account how he was at last strangely delivered by pirates. Unquote. It sort of unfolds like a pair of outstretched arms, as if trying to grasp the width of this great world that is described in it. Well, the year was 1719. An exploration of the New World was all the rage, and the exotic content of Robinson Crusoe seemed deftly suited to the times. The story of literature's most famous castaway sold well among Defoe's fellow Englishmen. But there's something else that appears to be at work in the worldly subtitle of Defoe's most celebrated work of fiction, which is also one of the first English novels. Carefully spading one detail upon another, Defoe sounds like he's trying to plant the reader in a rich sediment of fact. From the first page, Robinson Crusoe conveys sort of a documentary power. It's like a wildlife special. The question is, was Daniel Defoe trying to fool us into believing that the story was real?
The answer is, yes, he was. But it was a hoax. It was sometimes dry, like a police report. But then there was always a surprise around the corner. And it keeps you interested to see what's going to happen next. So his hoax worked, he was believed, and he probably sold a lot more copies than he would have otherwise. Of course, only some people believed it. Some people have accused Defoe of going too far in creating the novel's solid sense of reality. So, well, of course, a lot of readers believed that there really was somewhere a real flesh-and-blood Robinson Crusoe. The truth is that Daniel Defoe loved subterfuge. He promoted the illusion by telling readers that Robinson Crusoe had been written by Crusoe himself. It included a preface asserting the story as a, quote, just history of fact. We describe it as a novel now, of course, but it wasn't born that way. It was a hoax. Well, let's be a little charitable about his tactics, because he's writing novels when the form was new, and you could say that his casting of fiction as fact was simply a daring experiment within an emerging genre. It's hardly over. Look at Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, which so many people believe is realer than reality. If Daniel Defoe had been alive in the 20th century, he would have been an excellent employee of the KGB in Russia, putting out false stories about everybody that were believable, exciting, and cool enough to be accepted. Let's think about the Daily Journal he kept for a minute. It was not just a record of despair. Keeping the journal was an answer to the despair. His pen, as much as his axe or his musket, became a tool of survival. Robinson Crusoe, like the voice behind any masterpiece, was writing for his life. Well, let's go back to Philip Zelensky and his concern over the novel being changed and having huge parts of it cut out. He had five reasons that he thought it was important that this not be done. Earlier, we discussed the first four. Zelensky gives a fifth reason all this matters. He says it's because culture matters. Secularism has muddied the relationship between religion and culture. Even the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language gives this definition for culture. As the totality of socially transmitted behavior patterns, arts, beliefs, institutions, and all other products of human work and thought characteristic of a community or population. One thing on the list was beliefs. Are beliefs nothing more than a product of human work and thought? Oh, not so. Not entirely. Not for those who admit the possibility of divine revelation. Culture is the medium through which we hear the muffled voice of God. Religion without culture is dead. According to Christopher Dawson, that historian you know I prize, according to Christopher Dawson, a society which has lost its religion becomes sooner or later a society which has lost its culture. The reverse also holds. Without culture, religion will not long survive. The Benedictine monasteries were oases of the Catholic faith of Europe and withstood the barbarian centuries. These days, culture forms the battleground between the sacred and the profane. What happens next will have been generated on the playing fields of culture with the writers, artists, artisans, novelists, musicians, etc. Everything in a civilization is downstream of culture, comes from the culture, finds its source in it. Now, political activity does have its role to play, but we can pass all the laws we want, and they won't do any good if our culture remains marooned on a secular island. For writers, artists, and intellectuals, culture is the ark. There can be no other. It was an ailing culture that brought about the cultural decomposition, the breakdown of our families, and all the ruins that we see around us. There's cause for hope, because the way we got into this mess is the same way we'll get out of it. The way to get out of it is to go back the same way we got in it, through the media and through the arts. It was the storm of an adverse culture that shipwrecked us on a desert island. Culture must bring us out as well. And this is our hope. We can despair, but it was done rather easily. It was a massive effort, but a very directly and simply constructed effort. The media was the powerful tool that was used to subvert us, and we can be restored using the media. That's what real-life radio was all about,
That's what the Catholic media is all about. You really ought to support us. Become a cultural warrior. We're using the media to restore, to heal, to make our culture robust again by restoring the truth to it. Now, you can heal culture wounds with surgery. You can cut off from the large social mass and establish your own insular subcultures, alive to the presence of God. The Amish, the Hutterites, the Shakers come to mind. Doing it that way would discourage most human beings for reasons both practical and moral. Most of us are committed to a larger society, and I think we have good reason to hope. There's strong possibilities for the renewal of a genuinely spiritual culture. People are waking up. Baby boomers who abandoned the churches 20 years ago have streamed back into the pews. You hear Gregorian chants in the airwaves. Religion is re-erupting after a long suppression, the Reconquista. It's a Reconquista, a reconquering. Zaleski makes the humorous remark that at this moment more angels are clustered on the New York Times bestseller list than the head of any medieval pin. Science fiction has kept alive the eschatological imagination in this skeptical age. Spielberg's E.T. is a transparent Christ figure. As a matter of fact, in fantasy fiction, dragons are on the rebound. And in video games, can St. George be far behind? Even New Age spirituality, anathema to traditionalists, can be considered a welcome change from the secularism of the age. But we're experiencing a rejection of orthodoxy. And that has become a nearly inevitable phase in adolescent development. But people are finding their way back, sometimes around the barn, but they are. Sometimes they make an excursion into New Age or other alternative religions before they come back. How long can one dally with pastel and pink Aquarian cherubim for longing for an encounter with Gabriel's stately beauty? How long can one read poorly written channeled scripture before finding relief in the Bible? Everyone hungers for real substantial spiritual food. We should make it available. One thing we can do is retain whatever is worthy in our shipwreck culture. We can, we must, turn to tradition for guidance. As Robinson turned to the remnants of Christian England strewn along his beach, we're not recommending we returning wholesale to the past. It's a big task. When has it happened in history that a secular culture rebuilt itself on sacred foundations? I'd like to find that example. We need solutions as ingenious as any devised by our industrious hero, Robinson Crusoe. Like him, we must never despair. Like him, we have to find strength in prayer. You have to look at the damage we've done, that we have uprooted God from our homes, schools, books, arts. It's as if we've been washed overboard. Somewhere the boat of Peter, the bark of Peter, the Catholic Church, searches for us, waiting for us to climb aboard. God, the master mariner, never abandons his children. It's comforting to think about Robinson Crusoe finding salvation in a situation far more desperate than ours. For Setting the Record Straight, this is Chuck Coughlin. A favorite author of mine, Walter de la Mare, made a remark about Robinson Crusoe. He wrote, "Even to think of this admirable hermit is to be cheerful and to take heart of grace."
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.